Underworld, Disc 5.
Chapter 7. Marion leaned into me and laughed, watching the land surface expand around us. It was first light, a foil shimmer at desert's edge. At 300 feet we caught a mild westerly and drifted toward the eyelid slice of sun. But we didn't think we were moving. We thought the land was gliding by beneath us, showing a cluster of mobile homes, a truck on a blacktop to the south, and dogs barking up at us. They barked and leaped and ran yapping into each other as we strayed across the trailer park, passed from dog to dog, new dogs appearing at the fringes, twisting in mid-leap, dogs from nowhere, multiplying yaps and howls, a contagion to wake the known world. There we were, out over open earth, bone brown and deep in shadow, and we hung in the soft air, balanced in some unbodied lull, with a measure of creation spilling past. The pilot yanked the blast valve, and we heard the burners pulse and roar, and this made Marion laugh again. She talked and laughed incessantly, happy and scared. The basket wasn't large, barely taking the three of us, plus tanks, valves, wires, instruments, and coiled rope. Every propane wallop sent a man-sized streak of flame into the open throat of the nylon that bulbed out above us. Jerry, the pilot, said, "We need this wind to hold just like it is. Then we make it okay, I think. But we got to be buku lucky." This made us both laugh. We were lighter than air, laughing, and the balloon didn't seem like a piece of science so much as an improvised prayer. Jerry spaced the burns and kept an eye on the pyrometer, adding just enough heat to make up for routine cooling inside the envelope. It was a game, a larger-than-life toy we'd found ourselves wickered into, and our eyes went big at the whooshing flames. The balloon was candy-striped, and when Jerry pointed south, we spotted a road and a car, the chase car, a matching candy van that towed the small open trailer used to convey the balloon and basket. The surge of flame, the delayed rise, and Marion saying, "Greatest birthday present ever."
"Ain't seen nothing yet," I said.
She said, "What made you think of it? This is something I've always wanted to do without knowing it exactly. Or knowing it, but not at the level of ever making plans. You must have read my mind." Then she said, "I didn't know how much I needed to get out and see this landscape again. Too cooped up with job. But I never dreamed I'd be doing it from here. When you said 4 a.m., I thought, what sort of birthday are we talking about?"
"Now you know," I said. "But you only know the half of it."
We leaned close, my arm around her, our thighs pressing, and we were rocked and whirled, although not turning, whirled within ourselves, blood-whirled into quickened sense. I had my free hand around the iron bar, part of the rigid frame connecting the basket to the load cables, and I could feel the metal breathe in my fist. About 20 minutes later, Jerry touched me on the shoulder and pointed straight ahead, and I saw the first splash of sunlight on wingtips. The piece began to emerge out of distance and haze, the mesh rectangle completed now, ranks of aircraft appearing as one unit of fitted parts, a shaped weave of painted steel in the monochrome surround. Jerry said,
"Now if the Air Force don't shoot our asses off, we'll just mosey on over."
And that's what we did, approaching at an altitude of 400 feet. I felt Marion hanging a sort of tremulous gawk over the padded edge of the basket. It was a heart-shaking thing to see, bursts and serpentines of color, a power in the earth, and she pulled at my sweater and looked at me. Like, where are we, and what are we seeing, and who did it? The primaries were less aggressive than they'd seemed earlier. The reds were dampened, taken down by weather or more paint, deeper permeations. and this brought them ably into the piece. There were orderly slashes across the fuselages in one section, beautifully mixed blues and flat blues and near blues. The piece had a great riverine wash, a broad arc of sage green, or maybe mustard green, with brushy gray disturbances. And it curved from the southeast corner up and across the north edge, touching nearly a third of the massed aircraft, several planes completely covered in the pigment, the works circulating fluid naming the pace, holding the surface together. Like my God, Nick, how could this be here without my knowing? The tension of our pressed bodies was heightened by the physical fact of color, painted light pouring toward us. The sun burned high on the line divide. We had dropped to 200 feet, and Jerry ran a blast of flame. When we were nearly on it, the work grew rougher and frontal. I could see unpainted intervals, dead metal strips across the wings of several planes, peroxide white, scabby and gashed, and a trace of stenciled safety instructions apparent on one fuselage. The piece looked hard won. It lost its flow and became more deeply grained. Thick paint in uneven sheets, spray-gunned on. I saw the struggle to make it. Scores of people in this chalk heat, muscles and lungs. And I looked for the blonde girl in the flouncy skirt painted on a forward fuselage, and was elated to spot her, long and tall and unretouched. The nose art, the pin-up, the ordinary life and lucky sign that animated the work. I could see Marion try to absorb the number. She wasn't counting, but wanted to know, simply as a measure of her amazement. And when I whispered 230 at last count, she concentrated more deeply, testing the figure against the dense array, the giddiness of general effect. We passed directly over. The planes were enormous, of course. They were objects of hulking size, strato-fortresses, thick and massy, slab-finned, wings set high on the fuselage, a few missile pylons still intact, a few outrigger wheels suspended, the main wheels chalked on every plane. And truly I thought they were great things, painted to remark the end of an age and the beginning of something so different, only a vision such as this might suffice to augur it. And we moved toward the blank flats that framed the aircraft and saw how the work lost vigor at the fringes, giving way, melted by intention in the desert. Marion said, "I can never look at a painting the same way again."
"I can never look at an airplane."
"Or an airplane," she said. And I wondered if the piece was visible from space, like the land art of some lost Andean people. The breeze took us past, and the pilot yanked the blast handle, giving us a final inch-meal rise. We saw a cloud wall hung many miles to the east, and hawks floating in the unforced motion that makes you think they've been up there, the same two birds since Bible times. There were stones tumbled in the field, great bronze rocks with carved flanks. I felt my wife at my side. We saw dust blowing off the dark hills, and a pair of abandoned cars flopped in forage grass, convertibles with shredded tops. Everything we saw was ominous and shining, tense with the beauty of things that are normally unseen, even the cars gone to canker and rust. The pilot pointed to an object some miles away, and we saw it was the chase car, a droplet nosing down a long road toward the place on Earth where we would light. That night we had friends over for dinner, and the talk was swift and funny, flying cross-table well past midnight. And when they were gone, but also while they were there, they were still there when I felt the distance and stillness of that sprawled dawn like some endless sky waking inside me, flared against the laughter. When they were gone, we lay in bed. We slept in a book-walled room with creamy shelves and deep carpets and lighting that had a half-tone density, warm and whiskey-ish. Marian looked at a magazine, turning pages with a crispness that might have seemed short-tempered to someone who didn't know her habits. The long day.
The long drive. The drive was, oh boy, I said, a killer.
Is this the longest day of my life?
The drive was the screaming Mimi's. I hate those trucks, man.
I still feel the drive. But it was marvelous, all of it.
It was unmarvelous. It was marvelous because you slept.
She turned a page. Did you notice how they finish each other's sentences?
I drove, you slept.
She says, da-da-da. He says, dum-de-dum.
It's not the worst fate. I mean, even strangers do it. Everybody does it to somebody.
And I didn't sleep. I was one level down for 10 minutes.
It's the only way to get certain sentences finished.
They ate the roasted corn relish.
Of course they ate the roasted corn relish. The roasted corn relish was great.
Speaking of maps, I'd like to get some old maps. I hate our maps. Look at this. The rapture is approaching. October 28th. They give the exact date.
I saw that.
The mark of the beast. Did you see that? It's on the universal product code. Every product.
That's right. Every box of Jell-O they put through the scanner.
I'm having one of those nights, she said.
What?
One of those nighty nights.
What?
I'm having that sort of thing where I know I won't sleep. It's the knowing that does it. It's not the tired, because I'm actually very tired.
Restless.
No. It's a tired but not sleepy type thing. 666. So the supermarket is a weird sort of place.
We always knew it was.
I turned off my light and looked into the deep cream ceiling with my hands behind my head.
She's got a great body for how many kids?
Allison, 4 kids, I said. Which means I'm either half as great or twice as great, but let's not pursue it. What's his name? Terry was here, the heavyset one.
Been years since I looked at a real map. It's a sort of Robert Louis Stevenson thing to do. We have maps of highways and motels. Our maps have rest stops and wheelchair symbols.
Just tell me what his name is.
For what, the faucet?
Day before yesterday or yesterday. Today's been so long I don't know anymore. No, the showerhead.
The hell's wrong with the showerhead?
Our maps have pancake houses. What's his name with the orange pickup?
Which shower are we talking about?
Terry, right? She turned a page. She used a book pillow to read when she was in bed.
I ordered it for her out of a catalog.
Jewel-tone jacquard. A wedge-shaped cushion that nestles in the lap and holds your book or magazine at the proper angle, with tasseled bookmarks built in and a slot in back for your reading glasses.
I'm going Tuesday. I tell you that?
This is what, Moscow or Boston? Too soon for Moscow. Which is the heavy-set one? I get them completely.
I need to get these shoes resoled before I go. Remind me to do that tomorrow.
I have this thing on my leg.
It's not Boston, I said.
It's not Boston.
It's Portland.
It's Portland.
What thing? I said.
On the inside of my thigh.
Call Williamson.
It could be an irritation.
Call Williamson.
When did you get it? I don't know. I think it comes and goes. She turned a page. Lainey had the wallpaper today.
About time.
That was her that called.
I hope you didn't tell her.
Of course I didn't tell her. What was I going to tell her? Sweetheart, we drove right past but didn't stop.
Stopping would have been...
We saw them. When was it? Recent. Not that recent, actually.
Recent enough. We don't want to overdo it.
paper hangers. One was a woman, she said.
I'm still not completely over this motherfucking cold. Why is that? I said.
She turned a page.
Why is that? I said.
Take some of those antihistamines you take. They're hard to buy.
The tablets.
The caplets.
You're all revved up. I can feel the energy.
I'm not revved up. I'm tired. My mind is in that sort of place. You can forget about sleep, it's telling me.
I selected the jewel-tone jacquard over the ivory because the weave went well with our carpets.
I saw him in that orange truck he drives, the heavyset one. Last time I installed it myself, but this time nothing fit.
Because the universe is expanding. It expands in warm weather. Remind me, we need some 60-watt bulbs.
I pulled alongside, and he said he could be here in an hour. And he showed up exactly on time, and he installed the thing in exactly 10 minutes. And that was the end of that.
She turned a page, and then another. She had a way of sounding grim when she was actually showing satisfaction, showing completion, the finishing of a task, or the telling of a story with a moral.
Did you tell her to spackle?
They did the baby's room first.
Because this is not something Dex is going to figure out for himself. I only hope they spackled.
Take the 12-hour antihistamines. The 4-hour make you drowsy.
What's wrong with drowsy? Remind me we need bulbs for the pantry.
Just tell me his name. The heavy-set kid is the one whose father, right?
And had to be subdued by 4 or 5 cops.
Heavy-set.
Can't you call him fat? Call him fat. He's tremendously fat, I said.
He has rolls of fat, it's true.
Maybe the bulb's loose. Remind me to tighten the bulb. Too soon for Moscow. She turned a page. Is it a lump? I said.
What? No, I wouldn't use that word. No, it's an irritation.
Maybe it's the estrogen.
No, 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 no.
Call Williamson, I said. I turned on my side and heard a plane in a landing pattern, a late flight from somewhere. 8 hours of solid sleep, that's what I need.
It's true, actually. You've got one good pair of shoes, and they need fixing.
I almost bought some shoes in Italy. I almost bought some shoes in Italy. She turned a page.
What's the name of that stuff I wanted to tell your mother to use?
Oh, wait a second, I know.
It's on the tip of my tongue, she said.
Wait a second, I know.
You know the stuff I mean?
The sleep stuff or the indigestion?
It's on the tip of my tongue.
Wait a second, I know. About 3 hours later, I sat in the armchair in a corner of the bedroom feeling damp and cold. A chill sweat across my back and neck and under my arms. I'd come out of a dream, deep breathing and clammy, breathing fast and loud. So odd and loud and fast it woke me up, or something did. I had the baseball in my hand. Usually I kept the baseball on the bookshelves, wedged in a corner between straight-up books and slanted books, tented under books unceremoniously. But now I had it in my hand. You have to know the feel of a baseball in your hand, going back a while, connecting many things, before you can understand why a man would sit in a chair at 4 in the morning holding such an object, clutching it, how it fits the palm so reassuringly, the corked center making it buoyant in the hand, and the rough spots on an old ball, the marked skin, how an idle thumb likes to worry the scuffed horsehide. You squeeze a baseball. You kind of juice it or milk it. The resistance of the packed material makes you want to press harder. There's an equilibrium, an agreeable animal tension between the hard leather object and the sort of clawed hand, veins stretching with the effort. And the feel of raised seams across the fingertips, cloth contours like road bumps under the knuckle joints. How the whorled cotton can be seen as a magnified thumbprint, a blow-up of the convoluted ridges on the pad of your thumb. The ball was a deep sepia,
veneered with dirt and turf and generational sweat. It was old, bunged up. It was bashed and tobacco-juiced and stained by natural processes and by the lives behind it, weather-spattered and charactered as a seafront house. And it was smudged green near the Spalding trademark. It was still wearing a small green bruise where it had struck a pillar, according to the history that came with it. Flaked paint from a bolted column in the left field stands embedded in the surface of the ball. $34,500. How the hand works memories out of the baseball that have nothing to do with games of the usual sort. Bad luck, bronca luck, from him to me, the moment that makes the life. Marion caught me once looking at the ball. I was standing at the bookshelves with the ball in my hand, and she thought it was like Hamlet gazing on Yorick's skull, or maybe Aristotle, even better, she said, contemplating the bust of Homer. That was nice, we thought. Rembrandt's Homer and Thompson's Homer. We smiled at that. I thought of the old radio voice. Russ Hodges, dead now, 20 years or more. Disbelief and thrill, the force of a single human voice coming out of a box. She didn't ask whether it was Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, when I said it was not Boston, it was Portland. And I'd felt the question coming, layered in the sequence of our exchange, waiting to edge out. But one of us fell asleep before she could ask, which Portland, by the way, in those words exactly. I think I fell asleep first, but maybe not. The light was out. The last light was out. Then I came up out of a dream and felt my way to the armchair, breathing funny, and switched on the small reading lamp. And the crowd noise behind the voice, the incessant smash and tension, the thickness, the sort of bristle and team that deepened at a turn in play. A noise so dense it might have had a flashpoint, a heat to blow out the radio. I heard my mother in the next room getting up to go to the toilet. I listened to her come out of the room. I waited and listened, nearly breathless. I waited for the shuffle of slippers along the hall, for the pace, the familiar rate and pace of the shuffle. And then I listened for the sound of water flushing, fully intent, listening in the fiercest kind of concentrated stillness until she was safely back in bed. I hefted the weapon and pointed it, and saw an interested smile fall across his face, the slyest kind of shit-eating grin. Maybe that was the dream, I wasn't sure. Then I got the baseball from the bookshelves and sat in the armchair and looked into the whiskey cream ceiling. I didn't listen to the Dodger station that day. I listened to Russ Hodges instead, trying to work a reverse kind of luck. Never occurred to me at the time. I didn't think of it, in fact, until I sat in the armchair squeezing the baseball. But Russell Hodges, if you count the letters, if you're odd enough to think of doing such a thing, spinning out the full name and counting the characters, you may be amused to see Old 13. I felt calmer now. I felt all right. My arm hung over the side of the chair, and I squeezed the baseball, listening to Marion sleep breathe, squeezing it hard, the veins leveling on the back of my hand, going dead flat. Maybe we fell asleep simultaneously. Then I felt my way to the armchair and switched on the lamp. I stood there, pulling my pajama shirt away from my body where the sweat made it cling. Then I went to the bookshelves and got the baseball. She was sitting up. She wasn't exactly sitting up, she was propped. I realized she was awake, propped on an elbow, looking at me, rubbing her temple with her right hand. Nick? I'm here. You all right? Yes, I'll be there in a minute. Come back to bed. I'm all right. Go to sleep. It was a lovely birthday, wasn't it? Do you want me to turn out this light? No,
Just come to bed. I'll be there in a minute. I want you next to me, she said. I stood on the roof with my radio placed on the ledge, and sometimes I squatted and took the radio down with me, down behind the ledge, surrounding it, sort of, taking hope from it, suffering the game's slides and veers, rooting from the gut, and Emerson, maroon, that I took everywhere. But when I stood, I faced southwest, looking beyond the hospital for the incurable and past the elevated tracks on Third Avenue, looking toward the river that cuts the boroughs. That's where the polo ground stood, west by southwest. And I imagined the field and the players, the crisp blues and Elysian greens on that great somber-skied day, great and terrible. A day now gone to black and white in the film fade of memory. Manx Martin, Chapter 1. Then he remembers his books and goes back down the stairs, because you can't come home from school without your school books, fool. He forces the baseball into his side pocket and leans into the dim triangle behind the stairs, where the bottom of the first flight meets the floor, and he scoops the three books he left there in the morning. Slides them out and scoops them up, plus a composition book with a mottled cover, and he blows away the dust and smut and sourness. The janitor comes in the back door from the yards, the new janitor. He limps so bad you're not even sure you feel sorry for him. Maybe you wonder why he's walking around at all.
What's this?
Drop something, Cotter says.
I need to talk to your father.
When I see him.
Tell him, the man says.
Cotter can't figure out how the janitor knows who he is. The last janitor left in a hurry, and the new man just arrived, and he has four buildings he takes care of, and a limp that's hard to look at, and he already knows which son belongs to the matching father, and it's probably not a mistake. People always want to talk to his father. His father spends hours every day in flight from these conversations.
He climbs to four and goes inside. His sister is there, Rosie, poring over her homework at the kitchen table. Rosie's 16, always blasting away at the books, and he has two older brothers, one in Korea with the infantry and one in the airborne stationed in Georgia. This is the Peach State. But if Cotter had to choose between these two forms of employment, he thinks he'd rather face a weaponed enemy in snow and mud than walk out a door into the balmy evening air with a snatch of bundled silk hanging on his back.
What's he carrying in his pocket? Makes a person wonder, Rosie says. Looks like an apple to me. Maybe he went to an orchard on his day off.
What day off?
Travel upstate on a bus to pick some apples. Of course, we have apples right here, but that's for after school. No school, no apples. Is that why he found his own apple? If I didn't go to school, where did I go?
I don't know, but when I saw you from the window, you had no books. And when you walked in the door, lo and behold.
Then you know that's not an apple in my pocket.
He takes out the ball and does his flip trick, backspinning the thing over his hand and wrist, and catching it with a sort of gear-shift motion, elbow in reverse. This gets Rosie smiling, and she plants her face in the book again, which tells Cotter he has won a little victory, because it is only when this girl goes wordless that you know she is showing respect. In his room, he looks out the window, the room he used to share with his brothers, remarkably his own now. And then he drops the ball on the khaki blanket in the lower bunk. It is the only military touch, the sturdy olive drab, and he grabs a sweater off the chair back. He fits the sweater over his head and looks out the window again, watching people move through the streetlights and into the partial dark. Gets dark too soon. He stands and looks, just watching, being nobody in a window. And then he hears his mother pushing through the door. He snaps, too, thinking what he has to say if he is challenged about missing school. But he knows Rosie won't snitch on him. He thinks he knows this. He is confident, more or less. He thinks he feels her loyalty through the walls, and he goes into the kitchen where his mother is putting away groceries, and he drops a hand on Rosie's shoulder and stands at the table with an eye fixed on the bright boxes and cans his mother is placing on the shelves. His mother says, "How many times?"
"What?
Have you been told? Don't wear that sweater. I need to clean that sweater." "Plunge it in something strong," Rosie says. "That's a filthy sweater." "Take it to the cleaner, they'll give it back," Rosie says. "Rejected." See, the world is filled with things he's not supposed to do and not supposed to wear. But maybe he likes it when they array against him. It's different from his brothers, who bossed him a little and teased him a little, but didn't show this picky interest, this endless searching concern. His sister's head poked forward so she can study the particular jut of his dumbness. He likes running his fingers over the edge of the fruit bowl, over the speckled glaze, with Rosie's book sprawled on the table and the fruit in the bowl, and his mother doing things at the stove or cabinet. The way his mother talks to him and never looks in his direction but knows where he is and measures her voice to his sliding whereabouts, room by room. Maybe he wants them to figure him out so they can let him in on the secret. "The sweater's got burrs," Rosie says. She seems to like that word and puts a teasy nonchalance in her voice. "He's full of burrs from some apple orchard he must have visited some time or other." He runs his fingers over the inside edge of the bowl, feeling the sort of spatter of whirled material, the bubbly pinpoint warps. His mother tells him to wash his hands. She isn't looking at him, but she knows the state of his hands from the position of the sun and moon. He must be walking dirt, walking, talking filth man from the planet Dirt. At dinner, they are quiet. This is because his father is not here and might walk in any time. And then again, might not. And they are in a state of involuntary waiting. Funny how his mother pushes through the door, shouldering in with shopping bags and bundles, and her purse that she wears on a long strap over her head and across her body, maybe dragging a handled bag, or nudging it out of the hallway with a peg-leg motion, and making six kinds of noise, even when she's not carrying something, bringing the streets in with her, the subways, buses, and streets, all the noise and labor of getting uptown and downtown. That's his mother. And his father, usually sliding in unannounced, standing and glaring, stuck to the wall like he wandered in the wrong door and needs to work out the details of his mistake. His mother is tall and slightly lopsided, and she is strong. He knows this because he has lifted things she has lifted. He has come up four flights with things she often carries, and poker-faced. It takes her half a minute to work a smile out of those unused muscles. She says, "I saw that man who preaches in the street. Same place every time." "I did too," Carter says. "I said to myself, this man has a life even if we can't imagine it. This man goes home somewhere. But where does he go? How does he live? I try to imagine, what does he do when he's not out there preaching?" Rosie says, "I see these people lots of places. But this man's steady. Same place. I don't think he cares if people listen. He'll preach to cars going by." "What was he preaching?" "How no one knows the day or the hour. Seems there's been the Russians exploding an A-bomb, so no one knows the day or the hour. They announced it on the news." Rosie says, "I can't get worked up." "I got worked up. Until I started up the stairs with those shopping bags. Thought I was going to pull my shoulder out of the socket." "Back to normal," Rosie says. "But I stood and listened to him. I have to say, first time I listened to the man." "He's always there," Carter says. "First time I listened. No one knows the day or the hour. I believe this is Matthew 24.
I can't get worked up,
Rosie says. But the man has a life, and it's a mystery to me how he lives it.
People always preaching, Rosie says.
Those clothes he wears, I think it's a shame. And he's not a crazy man. He knows his scriptures.
You can know your scriptures, Carter says. There's people know their scriptures that are crazy as a loon.
Amen, says his sister. After dinner, he's back in his room looking out the window. He's supposed to be in his room doing his homework. And he's in his room, all right. But he doesn't know what his homework is supposed to be. He reads a few pages ahead in his world history book. They made history by the minute in those days. Every sentence is another war, a tremendous downfall. Memorize the dates. The downfall of the empire and the emergence of detergents. There's a kid in his class who eats pages from his history book nearly every day. The way he does it, he places the open book under the desk in his crotch and slyly crumples a page, easing it off the spine with the least amount of rustle. Then he has the strategy of wait a while before he brings his fist to his mouth in a sort of muffled cough with the page inside the fist, like whitesy-bitesy. Then he stuffs in the page and the tiny printed ink and the memorized dates, engrossing it quietly. He waits some more. He lets the page idle in his mouth. Then he chews it slowly and carefully and incomplete, damping the sound by making sure his teeth do not meet. And Carter tries to imagine how it tastes, all the paper points and edges washed in saliva, becoming soft and limp and blottered, so you can swallow smooth. He swallows not so smooth. You can see his Adam's apple jerk like he just landed a plane on a foreign shore. War and treaties. Eat your Wheaties. Rosie's in the shower now. He sits on his bunk and hears water beating on the other side of the wall, and he thinks about the game. He remembers things he didn't know he'd seen or heard. People on the exit ramp. He sees shirt colors and hears voices coming back to him. A cop on a horse. The boot shine and animal heat. And he hears water beating on the galvanized walls of the shower, the rattling, stain-walled shower that someone added to the bathroom years before. When his father comes in, there is no doubt of the entrance, the singing of the hinges when the door opens slowly, the way he does not carry sound with him out of the entranceway. There's no shaking out of clothes or heavy breath from the climb up the stairs. Not that you can't hear him at all. He maintains a presence near the door, a hearable something. Maybe just the tension of a man standing on a linoleum floor, or some tone that comes off his body, a tightness that says he's home. Carter sits on the lower bunk and waits. His father comes through the kitchen and appears in the doorway. Manx Martin. He's a working man, a furniture mover when he's employed, and a whiskey swigger when he's not. He looks at Carter and nods pointlessly. He stands there nodding, a gesture that has no point, that seems to mean, oh yeah, it's you, if it means anything at all. Then he comes in the room and sits on the unused bed, the cot. They listen to the water beating on the shower walls.
Had your dinner?
Meatloaf.
Leave some for me?
I don't know.
You don't know? Why? You left the table early? You had an appointment downtown?
He sees the man is kidding. His father's eyes go narrow, and he does his pencil-line smile. He's a man with high cheekbones, sort of poxed in the hollows, rough-graded, and a thin mustache that he keeps well above his lip, tended and particular. He looks around the room. He studies things. He seems to believe this is the right time to see what kind of surroundings his sons grew up in. He is average size, a little developed in the chest, a little bow-legged. And Carter wouldn't have thought he had the brawn to move heavy pieces up and down long flights of stairs. But he has seen his father lift and hoist with much bigger men.
Which one's in there?
Rosie,
washing up a storm.
The way she does homework, to the last ounce.
Finishes what she starts, Edgar.
It bothers Cotter in some lurking way to sit here with his father, talking about Rosie while they hear her in the shower. Just then the water stops.
Because I need to take a leak, you see.
Super wants to talk to you.
He's a yard dog, pay no mind.
How come he knows us if he just got here?
Maybe we're famous, you and me. Two hombres that they put out the word, these guys be mighty tough.
Cotter relaxes a little. He thinks maybe this is going to be all right. The man is feeling no pain, as they say, and there's something he can get from his father that he can't get from his mother.
Manx calls out, Rosie, baby, your daddy needs to use the facilities.
They hear a smothered word or two, and then she goes across the hall barefoot in a towel, and Manx stands and hitches his pants and clicks his tongue and walks out of the room. Cotter thinks without knowing it, without preparing the thought. He sees Bill Watterson on 8th Avenue with his jacket bunched in his hand. He picks up the baseball and looks at it and puts it down. His father is taking a king leak. You don't usually hear anything but the shower in there and noises from the pipes, but his father is taking a leak that is the all-time king. It's quickly becoming funny, the time span and force of the leak, and Cotter wishes his brothers were here so they could all be amazed together. He comes back in and sits down. He's still wearing his jacket, a corduroy windbreaker that used to belong to Randall. Speaking of brothers.
There now, are we feeling better?
How'd you like to write a letter for me? I need it for school, Cotter says.
Oh, yeah? It says what?
It says I missed a day due to illness.
Dear so-and-so.
That's right, like that.
Please excuse my son.
That's the way.
Duty he was ill.
Tell him it was a fever.
How feverish you get?
Say 100 ought to do it.
We don't want to be too modest if we're going to do this thing.
Okay. Has he had a fever of 102?
Of course, you look to me like you're in the pink.
Recovering nicely, thanks.
Except, what's that on your sweater?
I don't know. Burrs?
Burrs? This is Harlem. What kind of burrs?
I don't know. I guess I get around.
And where'd you get around to that you missed the day of school?
I went to the game.
The game?
At the polo grounds. Today.
You were at that game? Manx says. That made that fuss in the streets?
That's nothing. I was there as nothing. I got the ball he hit.
No, you didn't. What ball?
The home run that won the pennant,
Cotter says softly, a little reluctantly. Because it is such an astounding thing to say, and he is awed for the first time saying it.
No, you didn't.
I chased it down and got it.
Lying to my face. Manx says.
Not a lie. I got the ball, right here.
Know what you are? Manx says.
Cotter reaches for the ball.
You're a stick that makes a noise once in a while.
Cotter looks at him. He sits in the lower bunk with his back to the wall, looking out at the man on the opposite bed. Then he picks up the baseball. He takes it off the khaki blanket where it is sunk beside his thigh. He holds it out. He spins it on the tips of his fingers. He holds it high in his right hand and uses the other hand to spin it. He doesn't give a damn. He sports it. He shows it off. He feels anger and bluster come into his face.
Are you being straight with me?
Cotter does a little razzle, shaking the ball in his hand like it's too magical to hold steady. It's giving him palsy and making his eyes pop. He's doing it nasty and mad, staring down his old man.
Hey, are you being straight up with your dad?
Why would I lie?
Okay. Why would you? You wouldn't.
No reason for it.
All right. No reason. I can see that. Who else you tell?
Nobody.
You didn't tell your mother?
She'd tell me to give it back.
Manx laughs, puts his hands on his knees and peers at Cotter, then rocks back laughing.
Damn, yes. She'd march you up to the ballpark so you could give it back.
Cotter doesn't want to go too far with this. He knows the worst trap in the world is taking sides with his father against his mother. He has to be careful every which way, saying this and doing that, but the most careful thing of all is stick by his mother. Otherwise, he's dead.
All right. So what do we want to do? Maybe we go up to the ballpark in the morning and show them the ball. We bring your ticket stub, so at least they see you were at the game and sitting in the right section. But who do we ask for? Which door we go to? Maybe 17 people show up saying, this one's the ball. No, this one's the ball. I got it. I got it. I got it.
Cotter is listening to this.
Who pays attention to us? They see two coloreds from nowhere. They're going to believe some colored boy snatched the ball out of them legions in the crowd?
Manx pauses here, maybe waiting to hear an idea develop in his head.
I believe we need to write a letter.
Yeah.
We write you a letter for school, and then we write us both a letter and send it to the ball club.
Cotter is listening. He watches his father lapse into private thought, into worries and plots.
What are we saying in this letter?
We sent it registered.
Yeah. Give it the extra touch. We sent it with your ticket stub.
What are we saying?
We offering the ball for sale. What else we possibly be saying?
Cotter wants to get up and look out the window. He feels closed in and wants to be alone, doing nothing but watching the street from the window.
I don't want to sell it. I want to keep it.
Manx tilts his head to study the boy. This is a thought he has to adjust to. Keeping the ball around the house so it can gather dust and develop character. He says quietly,
keep it for what? We sell it, we buy you a wool sweater, and throw away that hermit shirt you got on. Look like you're living in a tree. We buy something for your mother and sister. Crazy to let the thing sit here and do nothing and earn nothing.
His voice is sensible and thought out, defining things for the teachable son. We are responsible to our family, not to the vanity of keepsakes and souvenirs.
We buy your mother a winter coat. Winter's coming, and she needs a heavy coat.
Cotter wants to be manly here, equal to the issues.
What kind of money they give us?
Don't know. Plain and simple, do not know. But they want this ball. They put it on display somewhere. I believe a letter is the thing that we send them registered mail. And we include your stub. What's that called? Your rain check.
I don't have a stub.
His father gets the look, the injured surprise, injury into the depths.
What are you trying to do to me?
I didn't get a stub.
Why not?
I didn't buy a ticket. I went over the gate.
What are you doing to me, son?
I didn't have money for a ticket, so I went over the gate. If I had the money, I'd have bought the ticket.
And he adds helplessly,
no money, no ticky.
His father's eyes get that drifty look. Cotter sees a kind of panic building, an intimate guilt that he has brought about by mentioning money, the ancient subject of being broke. His father is in retreat, his eyes treading inward, escaping the place he has just built for them both, the world of responsible things. This is a terrible moment. One of those times when Carter realizes he has won a struggle he didn't know was taking place. He has beat his father into surrender, into awful withdrawal. He says, "And anyway, the ticket stub doesn't say what section you sit in, unless it's reserve seat or box seat. So the ticket's no good for anything. People pick up tickets off the street."
His father says, "We sleep on it. How's that?"
Grimly getting to his feet.
"Nothing we can do tonight, so let's just get some sleep."
Carter doesn't mention the letter his father is supposed to write, the excuse for missing school. Maybe in the morning it'll be all right. And maybe he'll change his mind about selling the baseball. Or forget the whole thing. Carter knows if he can delay any action on the matter for a day and a half, his father will completely forget. This is one of the things they count on in this house, unspokenly. They sit around and wait for him to forget. He stands by the window and looks down at the street. In school, they tell him sometimes to stop looking out the windows, this teacher or that teacher. The answer is not out there, they tell him. And he always wants to say that's exactly where the answer is. Some people look out the windows, others eat their books. He gets undressed and goes to bed. He sleeps in his shorts and polo shirt. His mother comes in and says goodnight. Good night's fine, as long as she doesn't want to know what he and his father talked about. That's another trap that opens out of nowhere. She tells him she has to get up extra early to go to work, which is a long trip by subway down to 21st Street. She's a seamstress in a noisy loft with tall fans going. He worked there 4 hours a week last summer, sweeping fabric off the floor and rolling those cardboard barrels in and out. And they joked and teased him, 40 or 50 women, and said some very direct things. "Rosie'll get you up."
"I don't need any help," he says.
"If anybody in this world needs help getting up, you're the one."
"She throws things at me."
"Catch them and throw them back."
"Then I'll never get dressed, because she throws my clothes."
His mother leans into the bunk and kisses him, which he hasn't done in a long time. And then she rubs his head roughly, sort of knuckle-rubbing, and squeezes his cheeks so it hurts, twisting sizable sums of flesh. And he hears his father pass by on his way to the kitchen and hopes he missed the damn kiss. In the dark, he thinks about the game. The game comes rolling over him in a great warm wave of contented sleep. The game was lost, and then they won. The game could not be won, but then they won it, and it's won forever. This is the thing they can never take away. It is the first thing he will think of in the morning, and one part of him is already there, even as he falls asleep, waking up to think about the game. Manx Martin stands at the refrigerator. He's looking in at the meatloaf. She saved him some meatloaf that's sitting in a plate like the last meal of Prisoner X. He takes it out and sits at the table, eating slowly. His mind is in the throes of this and that. He sees the food in the plate and has to remind himself what it's there for. He puts the plate in the sink when he's finished and then decides to wash it and dry it. And he does this fastidiously, plus utensils. He knows he ought to fix the drip in the faucet, but we can save that for a day when there's a little free time. He puts the plate in the cabinet, whispers soft. Ivy comes in and doesn't look at him. She has a way of not looking at him that ought to be studied by science. That's how good she is at doing it, sweeping the room with her look, but missing him completely, a thing science ought to investigate for military use. She says,
"You were talking to him."
"Whose business is it?"
She says,
"What for?"
"I don't need any what for."
She says,
"Talking an awful long time."
"He's my son. Whose business is it?"
"Leave him alone. My business," she says.
That's what he wants. Left alone to grow up without advice from you. Only he won't say it himself.
Let him tell me.
She says, I'm telling you. She's moving through the kitchen doing things. She says, I'm leaving early in the morning. They have a rush order, which they're paying time and a half. He hears the radio playing faintly in their bedroom. So I'm giving you fair warning. That alarm's going off well before 6.
Before 6,
he says, and checks his watch, which doesn't work. And what's the difference anyway? And he says the words in a voice unconnected to the facts. She's in her house coat and house slippers, moving through the kitchen like a sleepwalker and a sleep talker, not giving him the barest glance. But she's connected to the facts, all right, and he is not. He is drifting out of range of the whole damn thing. The morning chill, the working wife, the harsh alarm that's getting ready, even as he stands here to populate his meager sleep. She finds the pills she's looking for and goes back down the hall. He stands and waits. He turns off the overhead light and stands in the dim glow of the lamp in the corner. He stands there for 15 minutes. A lifetime of thinking into a thing, trying to straighten out the mental involvements.
Okay. He goes and stands in the doorway of Cotter's room. He's looking into the room, getting accustomed to the dark. The boy is sleeping dead away. Manx steps into the room and sees the baseball almost at once. It is sitting in the open on the unused bed. This is what gets him every time. They obtain a valuable thing and don't even bother to hide it. Trust fairies to watch over their valuables. He told them how many times, protect what's yours. Because the way things are changing, you have to live defensive. He tries to recall which son slept in which bed when Cotter was a little kid on the top bunk. They came and went so damn fast. He stands in the dark room. He is arguing out the thought, should he do it or not? Then he does it. He takes the baseball. He does it before the argument ends. He does it to end the argument. He takes the ball and walks quietly through the kitchen to the door. The ball fits nice and easy in the roomy pocket of his windbreaker, his oldest son's windbreaker. He opens the door, squinching his face to draw off the noise. Need to oil the hinges when our mind's all clear and we have a little free time at our disposal. He eases the door shut and goes down the stairs and out onto the stoop, wondering how it happened that they're not wearing his hand-me-down jacket. He's wearing theirs. He looks both ways because he always looks both ways. Then he walks down the steps and into the street. Part 2. Elegy for Left Hand Alone. Mid-1980s to early 1990s. Chapter 1. It shows a man driving a car. It is the simplest sort of family video. You see a man at the wheel of a medium Dodge. It is just a kid aiming her camera through the rear window of the family car at the windshield of the car behind her. You know about families and their video cameras. You know how kids get involved, how the camera shows them that every subject is potentially charged. A million things they never see with the unaided eye. They investigate the meaning of inert objects and dumb pets, and they poke at family privacy. They learn to see things twice. It is the kid's own privacy that is being protected here. She is 12 years old, and her name is being withheld, even though she is neither the victim nor the perpetrator of the crime, but only the means of recording it. It shows a man in a sports shirt at the wheel of his car. There is nothing else to see. The car approaches briefly, then falls back. You know how children with cameras learn to work the exposed moments that define the family cluster. They break every trust.
spy out the undefended space, catching Mom coming out of the bathroom in her cumbrous robe and turban towel, looking bloodless and plucked. It is not a joke. They will shoot you sitting on the pot if they can manage a suitable vantage. The tape has the jostled sort of non-eventness that marks the family product. Of course, the man in this case is not a member of the family, but a stranger in a car. A random figure. Someone who has happened along in the slow lane. It shows a man in his 40s wearing a pale shirt open at the throat. The image washed by reflections and sun glint, with many jostled moments. It is not just another video homicide. It is a homicide recorded by a child who thought she was doing something simple and maybe halfway clever, shooting some tape of a man in a car. He sees the girl and waves briefly, wagging a hand without taking it off the wheel, an underplayed reaction that makes you like him. It is unrelenting footage that rolls on and on. It has an aimless determination, a persistence that lives outside the subject matter. You are looking into the mind of home video. It is innocent, it is aimless, it is determined, it is real. He is bald up the middle of his head. A nice guy in his 40s, whose whole life seems open to the handheld camera. But there is also an element of suspense. You keep on looking. Not because you know something is going to happen. Of course you do know something is going to happen, and you do look for that reason. But you might also keep on looking if you came across this footage for the first time without knowing the outcome. There is a crude power operating here. You keep on looking because things combine to hold you fast. A sense of the random, the amateurish, the accidental, the impending. You don't think of the tape as boring or interesting. It is crude, it is blunt, it is relentless. It is the jostled part of your mind. The film that runs through your hotel brain under all the thoughts you know you're thinking. The world is lurking in the camera, already framed, waiting for the boy or girl who will come along and take up the device, learn the instrument, shooting old granddad at breakfast, all stroked out so his nostrils gape, the cereal spoon baby-gripped in his pale fist. It shows a man alone in a medium Dodge. It seems to go on forever. There's something about the nature of the tape, the grain of the image, the sputtering black-and-white tones, the starkness. You think this is more real, truer to life than anything around you. The things around you have a rehearsed and layered and cosmetic look. The tape is super-real, or maybe under-real is the way you want to put it. It is what lies at the scraped bottom of all the layers you have added. And this is another reason why you keep on looking. The tape has a searing realness. It shows him giving an abbreviated wave, stiff-palmed, like a signal flag at a sighting. You know how families make up games? This is just another game in which the child invents the rules as she goes along. She likes the idea of videotaping a man in his car. She has probably never done it before, and she sees no reason to vary the format or terminate early or pan to another car. This is her game, and she is learning it and playing it at the same time. She feels halfway clever and inventive, and maybe slightly intrusive as well, a little bit of brazenness that spices any game. And you keep on looking. You look because this is the nature of the footage, to make a channeled path through time, to give things a shape and a destiny. Of course, if she had panned to another car, the right car at the precise time, she would have caught the gunman as he fired. The chance quality of the encounter. The victim, the killer, and the child with a camera. Random energies that approach a common point. There's something here that speaks to you directly, saying terrible things about forces beyond your control, lines of intersection that cut through history and logic and every reasonable layer of human expectation. She wandered into it. The girl got lost and wandered, clear-eyed, into horror. This is a children's story about straying too far from home. But it isn't the family car that serves as the instrument of the child's curiosity, her inclination to explore. It is the camera that puts her in the tale. You know about holidays and family celebrations and how somebody shows up with a camcorder and the relatives stand around and barely react because they're numbingly accustomed to the process of being taped and decked and shown on the VCR with a coffee and cake. He is hit soon after. If you've seen the tape many times, you know from the hand wave exactly when he will be hit. It is something, naturally, that you wait for. You say to your wife, if you're at home and she is there, "Now here is where he gets it." You say, "Janet, hurry up, this is where it happens." "Now here is where he gets it." You see him jolted, sort of wire-shocked. Then he seizes up and falls toward the door, or maybe leans or slides into the door, is the proper way to put it. It is awful and unremarkable at the same time. The car stays in the slow lane. It approaches briefly, then falls back. You don't usually call your wife over to the TV set. She has her programs, you have yours. But there's a certain urgency here. You want her to see how it looks. The tape has been running forever, and now the thing is finally going to happen, and you want her to be here when he's shot. Here it comes, all right. He is shot, head shot, and the camera reacts, the child reacts. There is a jolting movement, but she keeps on taping. There is a sympathetic response, a nerve response. Her heart is beating faster, but she keeps the camera trained on the subject as he slides into the door, and even as you see him die, you're thinking of the girl. At some level, the girl has to be present here, watching what you're watching, unprepared. The girl is seeing this cold, and you have to marvel at the fact that she keeps the tape rolling. It shows something awful and unaccompanied. You want your wife to see it because it is real this time, not fancy movie violence, the realness beneath the layers of cosmetic perception. Hurry up, Janet, here it comes. He dies so fast. There is no accompaniment of any kind. It is very stripped. You want to tell her it is realer than real, but then she will ask what that means. The way the camera reacts to the gunshot, a startle reaction that brings pity and terror into the frame, the girl's own shock, the girl's identification with the victim. You don't see the blood, which is probably trickling behind his ear and down the back of his neck. The way his head is twisted away from the door, the twist of the head gives you only a partial profile, and it's the wrong side. It's not the side where he was hit. And maybe you're being a little aggressive here, practically forcing your wife to watch. Why? What are you telling her? Are you making a little statement? Like, I'm going to ruin your day out of ordinary spite. Or a big statement? Like, this is the risk of existing. Either way, you're rubbing her face in this tape, and you don't know why. It shows the car drifting toward the guardrail, and then there's a jostling sense of two other lanes and part of another car, a split-second blur, and the tape ends here. Either because the girl stopped shooting, or because some central authority, the police or the district attorney or the TV station, decided there was nothing else you had to see. This is either the 10th or 11th homicide committed by the Texas Highway Killer. The number is uncertain because the police believe that one of the shootings may have been a copycat crime. And there is something about videotape, isn't there? And this particular kind of serial crime. This is a crime designed for random taping and immediate playing. You sit there and wonder if this kind of crime became more possible when the means of taping an event and playing it immediately without a neutral interval, a balancing space and time, became widely available. Taping and playing intensifies and compresses the event. It dangles a need to do it again. You sit there thinking that the serial murder has found its medium, or vice versa. An act of shadow technology, of compressed time and repeated images, stark and glary and unremarkable. It shows very little in the end. It is a famous murder because it is on tape, and because the murderer has done it many times, and because the crime was recorded by a child. So the child is involved. The video kid, as she is sometimes called, because they have to call her something. The tape is famous, and so is she. She is famous in the modern manner of people whose names are strategically withheld. They are famous without names or faces, spirits living apart from their bodies, the victims and witnesses, the underage criminals, out there somewhere at the edges of perception. Seeing someone at the moment he dies, dying unexpectedly, this is reason alone to stay fixed to the screen. It is instructional. Watching a man shot dead as he drives along on a sunny day, it demonstrates an elemental truth, that every breath you take has two possible endings. And that's another thing. There's a joke locked away here, a note of cruel slapstick, that you are willing to appreciate even if it makes you feel a little guilty. Maybe the victim's a chump, a sort of silent movie dupe, classically unlucky. He had it coming, in a sense, for letting himself be caught on camera. Because once the tape starts rolling, it can only end one way. This is what the context requires. You don't want Janet to give you any crap about it's on all the time. They show it 1,000 times a day. They show it because it exists. Because they have to show it. Because this is why they're out there. To provide our entertainment. The more you watch the tape, the deader and colder and more relentless it becomes. The tape sucks the air right out of your chest. But you watch it every time.
This ends Disc 5.